Well, good morning, everybody. Let's begin. There are some handouts at the door, and we will be in 1 Samuel chapter 18 and 19. Let's pray. Dear Lord, we thank you for this morning and for the opportunity to study your word. We ask that you would teach us by it, that we would learn both from the negative examples what to avoid and from the positive examples what to imitate. And we ask that as we learn about these characters in the Old Testament, you would also work to point us towards the New Testament and the fulfillment of all of these things in your Son, Jesus. Amen. Okay, so we want to talk about David and Saul's relationship this morning, and this is the breakup. You may or may not recall, but at one point, David and Saul got along well. In 1 Samuel 16:22, it says that Saul loved David greatly. David found favor in Saul's sight. And so they had a good relationship for a while, but that comes to an end now. In 1 Samuel 17, there was the promise of the reward for whoever defeated Goliath. It says, that man who kills him, the king, will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel. And so we would expect David's victory over Goliath to improve things for him, right? It's going to make it better. He's going to marry into the king's family after all. And the first reports we have after this battle are that Jonathan loves David. 1 Samuel 18, it says, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. We're going to talk about Jonathan in more detail in the future, but this is an important theme that Jonathan loves David and in fact is more loyal to David than to Saul. Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. This is one of the few covenants we read about that it's not a giant covenant with an entire nation. This isn't a covenant between God and man. This is between man and man. But it is important. This covenant between the two of them is a pledge of loyalty. It probably does have political implications. You know, Jonathan's men are going to also help David and David's men and so forth. But we have this ceremony. Jonathan takes off his robe, gives it to David, and his armor, his sword, his bow, and his belt. And so Jonathan is the literal son of the king, but this covenant is essentially making David a son of the king as well, sort of an adoptive right. And, of course, David's going to marry into this family too. Now, Saul, it says, takes David into his house and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. And this is both Saul wanting to adopt David politically, but this is also to prevent David from being too independent. This is an action that says, okay, David is now joining my house, with the emphasis of my house. We don't want David going back to his house or having some local loyalty. And so this adoption is to solidify Saul's presence and strength. It's not going to work, but that's the idea. And Saul actually does promote David. He makes him the head of all of the men of war. And it says David behaved wisely, was accepted in the sight of all the people, and in the sight of all Saul's servants. And so David is, he is a rising star at this point. And he is promoted, he's made the head over the whole army, which is pretty impressive since he basically came from nowhere. Again, this is one reason to think David is not a little boy at this time in history. He's still young, younger than the rest of the army, but that means 18, 19, 20 in that area.
And so David is a star. Everyone likes him, is eager to follow him. And this is what causes the problem. It all starts with an unfortunate song. It happened as they were coming home when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine. The women who had come out of the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines and joy and musical instruments. And the women sang as they danced, and they said, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s." And then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him. What's the problem? Jealousy, envy, but also nervousness, because, wait a minute, I'm the king, but they have ascribed to David 10,000, and to me only thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? And so Saul says, David is too popular, and the people are going to follow him and side with him. He's going to take over. And verse 9, my English translation says, Saul eyed David from that day forward, and in the margin it says, viewed with suspicion. In the Hebrew, it literally says, viewed him or looked upon him as guilty. And so the idea is that Saul has categorized David as an insurrectionist, a revolutionary, someone who is going to take his throne. And so things are not good. And then comes again the evil spirit. The next day, the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. And so David played music with his hand, as at the other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, "I will pin David to the wall." But David escaped his presence twice. Now, I think Saul's trying to kill him here at this point. Pin him to the wall. Sometimes people interpret that as meaning, you know, pin his cloak or something. I think he means pin him. He's going to kill him. And the evil spirit is the immediate cause, but it's playing on the feelings that were already present, right? And it's interesting, this is, again, a spirit from the Lord, but the Lord is in charge of all of the spirits, really, is what's going on. And so there's a lesson here that spiritual instigation of sin is almost never, I can't say never, never, but almost never is it this, you know, full bodily possession where you're just grabbed and you can't control what you're doing and it takes over. Almost always, spiritual temptation, spiritual facilitation from evil spirits, it always plays on your own sin that's already there. Your own inclinations, your own desires. Saul is already thinking about killing David before any evil spirit comes to him. The spirit just gives him the shove. And so we have to know that this is how spiritual warfare happens. The devil is not trying to give you brand new ideas that you've never thought of. He's trying to take those evil thoughts that you've already been considering in miniature and making them seem a lot better ideas. You know, giving you just a little nudge in the direction you already wanted to go. What's interesting here, this evil spirit causes Saul to prophesy. And we'll talk about this a little bit later, but Saul apparently can prophesy. He does it at least three times, and so it's a little bit curious here. He's a sort of a prophet. what he prophesies, not entirely clear. Prophecy is not only the predicting of the future, but it is the proclaiming of God's will. And so it may be the case that Saul is prophesying. He's saying things that are true, whether he wants them to be true or not, you know, whether he likes them or not. They're coming out. There may be utterances that will be his own condemnation. That happens sometimes. We don't know, but he is prophesying here, and he will prophesy in the future. And David escapes his presence, and notice what it says. Saul was afraid of David. Now, Saul's the one with the spear in his hand, right? He's the king. He's the one trying to kill David, but he is afraid. Verse 12 tells us why he is afraid. Because the Lord was with him, with David, but had departed from Saul. So he knew it. Saul could tell that the Lord had shifted to supporting David. The allegiance was gone. And just because someone has earthly power, which Saul did, I mean, Saul's the king. He has the power over all of Israel. It doesn't mean that you have the real power. And this is always a sort of a mystery in life, how people have power. Ordinarily, it's through the official forms, the official positions, but not always. You can have de facto power, even if you don't have de jure power. And sometimes the power is sort of charismatic and spiritual. And so Saul just knows he doesn't have it. And so he is scared. And Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. This is actually a demotion. Previously, he had made David the head over all of the men of war. Now he's the head over 1,000, or a legion, perhaps. And he's trying to now send David out into battle in the hopes that David will be killed. So instead of being the central command, instead of being the head over the whole army, now we're going to give you a local battalion and send you out on jobs. And so Saul is trying to get rid of David this way. But David behaved wisely, and the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he behaved wisely, he was afraid. And so Saul is getting more anxious, more nervous. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. And this expression, he went out and came in, it's something we see a couple of times in the Old Testament. And it has to do with sort of local, personal leadership, decision-making, and the idea that you're accessible, available, and you sort of know what's going on with the people. David goes out and comes in before them, the people. He is actually fighting the battles. He is there amongst them, and they love him because of this. And so Saul now is afraid of David. He's afraid that David is going to be the new king. The people are going to side with him. The Lord has already sided with him. And so Saul has to think of a way to deal with David. And he's going to try to kill him. We have sort of a miniature which will be repeated. This is another interesting thing about this story. Saul throws a spear at him, tries to kill him, and then he sends him out to fight battles, hoping he'll die. That's going to get repeated now. Same thing's going to happen again, only a little bit different, a little exaggerated. And so the next thing Saul does is he marries his daughter to David. Now, he does this as a plot. Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. Meaning, you can marry my daughter, but you have to go fight some more. And Saul thought, let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. And so he is trying to give David an obligation to fight more battles, to be on the battlefield, in the line of combat, in the hopes that he will die. Now, this promise to marry his daughter, it ought not come with any more obligation, really. Because, you remember, that was the reward for killing Goliath. David had already earned this marriage. And so, for Saul to add further conditions here is an act of dishonesty, an act of sort of corruption, making him do more than he needed to. And he's doing this in the hope that David will be killed. And David responds, whether or not this is a genuine response, if this is political, it's not entirely clear, but he pleads that he's too humble, he's too low, too meager for this. Who am I? What is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? And so implied here is the idea that David's not of the stature and class to marry into Saul's family. Is he saying this to because he knows the marriage is dangerous? He's trying to avoid it, maybe. Is this just sort of court, right, you know, courtly rituals where you're always supposed to say this? You know, oh no, I could never do that. And then, of course, you do it. Maybe. It's not entirely clear. But whatever happens in this exchange, Saul ends up giving his daughter to someone else. It happened at the time when Merab should have been given to David. She was given to Adriel, the Mahalathite, as a wife. And so we move to daughter number two, Michal. It's actually expelled in Hebrew the same way as Michael, but in English we take the E out, so Michal. The female version of Michael. Michael's an interesting name, you know, because in English, it's male is Michael and female is Michelle, you know, but in French, Michelle is actually the male name. So, you know, it's one of these names that different languages kind of keep because of its significance, but then they juggle it a little bit. So this is just the female version of Michael, which means God, the Lord, will judge. It's fairly interesting that the name of this woman, the Lord will judge, she's given to David. She, though, it says, loved David. So this is not only political at this point, though it is political. She loved David. So she sees how good of a fighter and a leader and how popular he is, and he is wise, the Lord is with him. So she loves David. And they told Saul. I always think that's interesting. Who told Saul? People working in the court, you know. This, even though this is not medieval Europe, the arrangements are similar. Saul is not with his kids all the time. He's at court. So there are people who are taking care of his children. And so they tell Saul, hey, Michal really thinks David is something. You know, she's got eyes for David. And the thing pleased Saul. He said, all right, have another daughter I can marry off. And so he uses Michal now and says, I will give her to him that she may be a snare and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, you shall be my son-in-law today. She shall be a snare to him. It could also be translated bait. She's going to be bait. He will take her and marry her, and then he'll have to do what I ask. And I think implied in here is perhaps that David, he was interested in Michal. He wasn't so interested in the first one. He could stall a little bit, not so interested, but something about the second girl, there's an interest here. She likes him, and she's bait for David. And so we try again. Saul commanded his servants, communicate with David secretly and say, look, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law. So we can tell that David is suspicious. David, he's had the guy threw a spear at him. I mean, he is not going to just accept this offer right away. And so Saul has to work through some intermediaries here, grease the skids, try to say, no, that was a bad day. Get that evil spirit thing going on. You can't take it personally. He loves you. Marry into the family. Come on. Everybody loves you, David. And so they did. They spoke these words in the hearing of David. David responds the same way he did the first time. Does it seem to you a light thing to be a king's son-in-law, seeing that I am poor and lightly esteemed? And they tell Saul again. And now we get the explanation of why, at least one level to why this would be a problem, the dowry. David says, is it a light thing to be the king's son-in-law, seeing that I am poor? I can't marry the king's daughter. Literally, I can't. I don't have the means. The dowry is a problem. To marry the king's daughter would require some money, some cash. If you like it, you got to put a ring on it. And for the king's wife, that's got to be some bling, right? And so David is he's not confident in his ability to appropriately provide for this. The dowry or the bride price is common, of course, all over the world, especially the ancient world. See it in the Old Testament. In Genesis, it comes up, and as well, there's laws about it in Exodus. The man's family gives the woman's family a certain set of money in order for them to marry. Now, this gets reversed when you get into the Middle Ages. In Europe, the women's family often had to give the man money, which is sort of an interesting reversal. Probably tells you about the conditions of political marriages in Europe at that time, also that they weren't really following Old Testament customs. In the Old Testament, though, the man's family gives the woman's family money, probably as a form of insurance in case he dies. She's going to need some money. I do not think this is a prenuptial agreement. Sometimes people use it that way, but I think that's too anachronistic. I think the idea in the Old Testament that you would plan for divorce is just out of hand. And so this is, I think, in the case that he dies, that she needs provision. And we do carry this tradition on in some ways. This sort of topic pops up from time to time in Christian courtship conversations. Should a man continue to pay the woman a dowry or have some accommodation to that? And I do think this is where the idea of a diamond ring really comes from. It doesn't quite work that way anymore, but the idea was you gave her something of value that she could have, and that if need be, she could use that to provide for herself if the man was no longer there. In the Visigoth tradition there in Spain, and they came through that to Mexico. It's still carried on in some parts of Mexico. That man actually gives the woman a little pouch of gold coins. And so there is a parallel here that this idea continued in some form. It sounds weird to people today to talk about a dowry or bride price. I always laugh, but it has in fact continued, even though we don't necessarily remember it or know about it. I've heard some people suggest that maybe a insurance policy today would be a sufficient form of a dowry. Something to consider. I don't think you can do anything overly demanding on this case that we should always do it, but it is something that's been with most of human history, some form of a dowry. But this dowry can be waived or substituted. And Saul is going to have a very unusual substitution. David says, I can't afford the dowry. And so Saul says, okay, here's what we're going to ask him to pay. Verse 25. The king does not desire any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines. So there you go. David, you can get those, right? That's something that is within your abilities. Go out and kill 100 Philistines and bring back their foreskins. And so this is not quite scalping like the Native Americans, but similar. A physical evidence that you have killed these people. And of course, the fact that it's a foreskin is connected to the cleanliness requirements, where the presence of foreskins, as David said to Goliath, is a reproach. There shouldn't be any in the Holy Land. That sounds really odd and weird and creepy to say today, I know, but that is what's going on here. There shouldn't be any Gentiles in the Holy Land, at least not Gentile enemies. And so get rid of them and bring back the symbol of them to the king. Take vengeance on the king's enemies. Now, it tells us that Saul hoped that David would be killed. Again, this is more of the trap. Saul thought to make David fall by the hands of the Philistines. But when his servants told David these words, it pleased David. He said, I can do that. And so when the days had not expired, he arose, went out, and he doubles it. He kills 200 men of the Philistines. And this verse is darkly humorous, a little gross. He brought their foreskins, and they gave them full count in front of the king. So he showed that he had 200 of them, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, as a wife. And so David does marry into Saul's family now. He is the son-in-law to the king, and he is basically, for all political purposes, the son of the king. Thus Saul saw and knew the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, and Saul was still more afraid. And so as David improves and rises and does more things and keeps ascending, Saul dislikes him more and more. Saul became David's enemy continually. And so Saul is being further enraged, further anxious, worried, that surely it's just a matter of time before David becomes the king. And so as much as David succeeds, the worse Saul's feelings are about him. And the princes of the Philistines went out to war. And whenever they went out, David behaved more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name became highly esteemed. And so that David behaving wisely is repeated several times in that chapter. David knows the situation here. He's not naive. He understands that he is in a perilous position in some respects, but in other respects, he knows that this is where he's supposed to be. He is the anointed, after all. He has to be here. And so he is still loyal to Saul, and that continues his whole life, by the way. Always loyal to Saul, but he's wise, and he knows that Saul is not necessarily to be trusted. And that's a message that's tricky to understand, but is important. Christians should love all people, and we should submit to all authorities. This doesn't mean, though, that we trust everyone. This doesn't mean that we are blind to the obvious. And that is really a tricky thing for people to handle. You know, salute the uniform. Even though you know the person wearing it might have all sorts of problems. And the saluting of the uniform is not saying that you're going to overlook the problems or not worry about them or just blind yourself. It's a dual relationship here. We should be the most loyal people on earth, and we should still be able to be wise and understand what's going on. Usually you do one or the other, right? You're wise and disloyal, or you're loyal and naive. And so we have to be able to bring those together. And we're loyal, we are doing our duty, doing what's right, but we're also behaving wise, letting you know what's going on. And if we have someone who's in charge over us who's evil, we have to deal with that appropriately. We have to be smart about it. And this is why Christians can go into politics. I mean, it's tricky. I wouldn't recommend everybody do it, but it's okay. It's not the fact of political sort of jockeying is not off limits. The way that you do it, how you do it, what it makes you have to do in the rest of your life. But David is in this world. He's having to behave a certain way, be very careful. And so Saul now is going to attempt to kill David again. He's going to try another time. And he works through Jonathan this time. He tries to get Jonathan to kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. And so Jonathan told David, saying, "My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning, and stay in a secret place and hide. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are. I will speak with my father about you, and what I observe I will tell you." Now, this is very dangerous for Jonathan. And we have to understand this about his character, that he too is in this dilemma. This is his dad, and he's betraying his dad. He is. I mean, he's not leading a revolution against his dad, but he is betraying his dad. He is telling David the inside scoop. He's helping David avoid being killed by his dad, and he is promoting his father's rival. So, pretty weighty stuff. He does it in a certain way, doesn't he? He's not externally instigating rebellion, but he is. I mean, if you were Saul and you knew about this, you would interpret this as betrayal, absolutely. And so Jonathan prevents David from being killed. And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, because his works have been very good to you. For he took his life in his hands, and he killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause?" Now, this is incredible. We shouldn't read this and assume, you know, just like you talking to your dad casually. Even that's hard, by the way. I mean, even if you're just on the back porch of your dad trying to tell him he's wrong about something mundane, that's not easy. Now imagine your dad's the king. He wants to kill someone because he's deemed them an enemy of the state, and you're telling him that that's sin. This is pretty extreme, pretty difficult. And so it tells us about Jonathan's character. He is brave, he is noble, and he's risking his own neck a little bit too. I mean, he has reason to think his dad's not going to kill him, but this is still dangerous stuff. But Saul listens. Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed." And then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. Now, this is one part of the story that sometimes we forget. It wasn't just a clean break, and then David and Saul are enemies forever. There's this back and forth. David is now back in Saul's court. I mean, he's married into Saul's family. He's back in the court. Saul says, "I'm not going to kill him." And I don't think that Saul is simply lying here. We have to take into account Saul's sort of mental, spiritual state. It goes up and down. It really does. He doesn't simply fall and go completely bad forever. That's too easy. He really is back and forth, up and down, jealous, anxious, maybe good again, not so sure. This relationship is constantly back and forth. And what makes it go bad again, now that he's sort of befriended David again, he thinks he's going to be his buddy again, but it goes bad again because there's war again. And what does war do to the society? Puts people on edge, and the guy who's in charge is either going to win decisively or he's going to lose. The war is a time for power to be questioned. And David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. And so again, as David is successful and victorious, Saul is more worried, more anxious, more against him. And now what else happens? The distressing spirit comes back. And so that's the final straw. And David was playing music with his hand. So we had tried to go back to the way the relationship was originally. David can calm the spirit and get the spirit out of Saul, but no. Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear a second time. But he slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped. So this is the second direct attempt to kill him now with the spear. And now again, we're going to try to kill him through the wife. We're going to use the wife as a plot. And so Saul tries to get Michal to betray David. Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him and kill him in the morning. So when he's asleep and not able to defend himself. And Michal, David's wife, tells David. So a second child of Saul is more loyal to David than to Saul. And she says, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." And so Michal let David down through a window. And he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed and put a cover of goat's hair for his head and covered it with clothes. Now, when I was reading this, again, I kind of chuckled a little here. The word for image is the same word for idol. So she's taking one of the household idols, which, what's she even doing with that? That's an interesting question. That, again, is a little clue here. Israel is never in an ideal society situation. That's a myth whenever people think like at one point in history they did it right. They never did. Saul's daughter has idols in the house. And they are basically man-sized, at least big enough to look like a man in the bed. Saul, is he worshiping idols? Probably. His religion is at best, you know, mixed, watered down, syncretistic. And so this also explains how it could go bad so quickly, by the way. I mean, David is good, Solomon is sort of good, sort of bad, and then immediately after Solomon dies, they have golden calves that they're worshiping again. So there is syncretism in Israel throughout. So Michal takes the idol, the household idol, and she does the old trick, right? Put it under the covers, give it some straw for hair, goat's hair on his head, cover it up, put on clothes, so it looks like there's a man in there. Saul sent messengers to kill David, but she said, he's sick, can't go in there yet. So they stake it out and they watch, they say, bring him up to me in the bed. And so they come in to get him and they discover the trick. There's not a man in here at all. This is a statue. And Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped? And so at this point, Michal lies. She says, oh, he said, let me go. Why should I kill you? Which means, if you don't let me go, I will kill you. And I don't want to do that, so let me go. It's not how it happened. She's lying here, probably to save her skin. That's probably what's going on. Or maybe she just is scared. But anyway, she doesn't tell the truth. But this also continues to allow David more escape as well. She is not punished at this point. David fled and escaped, and he goes to Samuel. Don't forget about Samuel. He was a major character, and then he's kind of dropped out. He's still around. Samuel is at Ramah, and David goes to him and tells him what's going on. And then the two of them go to Naoth. Eventually, David will continue to run. He'll go to Nob, and then all the way outside of Israel, or outside the people of Israel, to the Philistines. He goes to Gath eventually, which is pretty amazing, because that's where Goliath is from. So this exodus from the people of God to the enemies of God is something we see a lot in the Old Testament, isn't it? Whereas Israel becomes the bad place, and the remnant have to live amongst the Gentiles. That's a major theme all throughout the Bible. And David is going to do that in his person. But for now, he's with Samuel. And he's asking for help. He's telling him what's going on. And Saul hears about it and sends messengers there. And this is interesting. Verse 20, chapter 19, verse 20. Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the group of prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they prophesied also. Samuel was not an individual prophet. Samuel was the dean of prophet school. He's the president of the seminary. Samuel is teaching other prophets. They are studying with him. Samuel is the father of the prophets, the head of the prophets, and there's a whole school there. And this goes on all throughout the kingdom period, by the way. Elisha has a school of prophets under him. And this is how we have prophets running around. Sometimes we forget about this because we're only thinking about the main characters. And so we sort of think about the patriarch period as sort of clans and just father figures. And then we move into the nation state. We have kings. And then the prophets show up at the end. But really the prophets are here the whole time. The prophets are studying under Samuel. They're going to study under Elisha. David has a court prophet, doesn't he? Nathan. we know it from when he rebukes him, but he's there. So there are prophets all along. Samuel is the head of the school of the prophets. Now what's interesting is when Saul's men get here, they start prophesying. They break out into prophecy, just like Saul had prophesied earlier. And it doesn't say, it doesn't tell us what they said, but the point is to make it clear the Spirit of the Lord is with Samuel and with David in such a way that even when the enemies get there, they get taken over by the Spirit of the Lord. And probably the Lord is speaking things that they don't want to say, that they don't agree with. It's not their speech, but it's God's speech coming out of them. And this is to be a sign. This is proof of which side the Lord is on. And so Saul has to come in person. When Saul was told, he sent more messengers and they prophesied. And he sends them a third time and they prophesied. And so there's something funny about this, because Saul's sending these men here to say, hey, give us David, we're going to kill y'all. But when they get there, they can't say that. All they can say is whatever God is saying through them. And so Saul is continually frustrated here. Well, what's going on? Why are my people not doing what I need them to do? They're prophesying. So he went also. And he spoke to them, where are Samuel and David? And they said, they are at Naoth. So he went there. And what happens to Saul? He begins to prophesy. The Spirit of the Lord of God was upon him also. And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naoth. So he's prophesying the whole way here. And again, the implication is against his will. He's not happy to be doing this, but he is. And what is he saying? We don't know, but my guess is he's saying things that confirm that God is with David. He's testifying against himself, really. And when he gets to Naoth, he stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner. And he lay down naked all that day and night. He's completely humiliated and not in control of himself. The Lord has humbled him and put him down, and this is the king after all. And so he's stripped literally, but it's also, stripping him of any sort of authority he might try to use. And he is basically paralyzed, in a sense. He's prophesying day and night. And therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? They had said this earlier in chapter 10. In chapter 10, it seemed to be fairly positive. Saul had been recently anointed as king. And the signs are confirming that. He goes and talks with Samuel, and then he goes to a hill where prophets are, and the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. And all who formerly knew him saw that he prophesied, and said, what is this that has come upon him? Is Saul also among the prophets? And a man from there answered, who is their father? And it became a proverb, is Saul also among the prophets? And so the idea then was that this was confirming Saul. Yes, he's among the prophets, and Samuel is their father. So Saul and Samuel are together, and they're on the same team. But now it's doing the opposite. It's confirming that the Lord is not with Saul. Saul is prophesying and among the prophets, but he's prophesying for David, essentially. Very mysterious here. And there are many, many places in Scripture where we realize we're dealing with something we're not real familiar with. This is a part of world history that we're just, today, we don't quite get. But this idea of the prophets being a presence that speaks and confirms God's desires and powers and support is central to Israel. And if the prophets turn against you, it's over. Now, the prophets don't do it. You know, they're not the secret power behind the scenes or anything, but they are telling you what's going to happen. And when the prophets prophesy against you, there's really nothing you can do. In some cases, you can repent, of course, and then the judgment will relent, but you can't thwart it. And so Saul not only is prophesied against, but is actually turned into a prophet to speak against himself. God grabs him and works in and through him. And there's something lingering about Saul. And I don't know quite what to make of this. Does he completely fall away from God? And there are people who have answered yes and the people who have answered no. And I think the majority answer is probably that yes, he does eventually fall away totally. But it's a little ambiguous all throughout. You get the sense that you have a man at war with himself in Saul. And he's got to know, I just prophesied. God just got in me and worked through me and spoke. And so it's not an intellectual, knowledge issue here. It's Saul accepting what he knows. And he can't quite ever do that. You know, something in him where he knows David is the man. David is the Lord's anointed. God is with David.
Yeah. If you read the entire narrative, it's almost like he has some mental issues, some paranoia or something else going on.
Well, certainly. I mean, he's had an evil spirit coming to him on and off, making him act crazy as well. So, yeah, there's definitely something going on with Saul, and yeah, he's acting against his own knowledge and even his own conscience in a way. Yeah, it's very curious. And so from this point on, David is not going to return to Saul. It's over. He's not working in his court. He's not even trying. He knows that it's basically war between the two parties. But I think both men know how it's going to end. Why don't we close in prayer? Father in heaven, we do thank you for your word. We ask that you would teach us by it, that we would not be as Saul was, we would not be envious, and we would not fight against your chosen one. But we would also ask that you would teach us to be as David was, and as we are wise, that we would be loyal. As we are smart and seeking to do what is right, what protects us in your will, we also ask you'd give us humility, that you'd give us patience and gentleness. We ask you would help us to follow your will rightly. And we ask, God, that you would teach us by your word that we could prophesy to speak your will, that we would know what it is that is your desire, and that we would promote it, that we would follow after you, and that you would be on our side, protecting us from our enemies and giving us victory through your Son, Jesus. Amen.